Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. Monday marks the 50th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, the Supreme Court's historic decision declaring racially segregated schools unconstitutional. But despite Brown's renown, African-American Harvard law professor Charles Ogletree Jr. argues the landmark decision has not resulted in the lasting desegregation of America's schools or equality in American education. Tonight on Point, one man's and one nation's journey through the Brown v. Board of Education saga. But first, an election shocker in India today that will return to power the first family of Indian politics, the Gandhis. Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee resigned today, leaving Sonia Gandhi, the Italian-born widow of former Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi, to take the helm of the world's largest democracy. Her Congress party's victory over Vajpayee's BJP marks one of the most dramatic political upsets since Indian independence nearly 60 years ago. Monica Chopra covers India for the Boston Globe. I asked her to describe how Sonia Gandhi came to lead the Congress party.
She actually was married into the Gandhi family. She married the elder son of Mrs. Indira Gandhi, Rajiv Gandhi. And she met Rajiv while she was studying in Cambridge in London. They got married, and she was essentially a very private person, was not really in the public eye, even though she was married into the first family of India. It was only after her mother-in-law's death, when Rajiv Gandhi took over the reins of the Congress party, that we got to see what she was all about, and she was not really comfortable in her husband joining politics. Later, after his assassination, she also got sucked in into the whole political mainstream of India, and she then transformed herself from a shy person into a politician.
Of course, both Indira Gandhi and Rajiv Gandhi, her husband, were assassinated. How did she appear to deal with those terrible losses?
At a personal level, she was very distraught. Clearly, she would have been, but she also was not familiar with the way Indian politics and subcontinent politics works. So this was the downside of being married into a very prominent family. And after her mother-in-law's death, the story goes that she begged her husband that just don't join politics because it's the same thing's going to happen to you. And she had on record said, I'd rather that my children beg on the streets than you join politics. But he was able to convince her, and the rest, as you say, is history. Even her children, when she wasn't comfortable with the idea of her children joining politics. So till the very last minute, in fact, only till these elections have the children really come out and come into the political arena.
How important was Sonia Gandhi to this stunning Congress party victory in India?
I think she almost single-handedly was responsible for the victory because she crisscrossed the country and nobody gave the Congress a chance against the BJP. Even within the Congress, there were a lot of skeptics that she would be able to manage to pull it off. But I think through determination, she was the one who was responsible in getting the Congress together. And I think one should realize that the victory for the Congress party is not so much a victory for the Congress as much as an anti-BJP vote. So the party really has to get itself organized. There is a lot of support for the party, no doubt, but it's not a pro-Congress vote in that sense.
That is a vote against the Hindu Nationalist Party and the beneficiary of that, the Congress party. Sonia Gandhi is 58 now, said to be shy,
right,
politically stilted. What's her reputation among ordinary Indians? She's Italian-born. Will she actually be the prime minister?
Very likely that she becomes the prime minister because, don't forget, the Congress now is the single largest party which has been voted into parliament. Together with the alliance of left parties and some regional parties, they have a comfortable majority coming in into the parliament. And the left parties have gone and said publicly that they don't mind supporting her as a prime minister, provided there's a common minimum program that both the parties can agree on. As far as the common man is concerned, there is a lot of mystique about Sonia Gandhi and the Gandhi family and the Nehru-Gandhi charisma, which still you can see on, you know, the common man really looks up to the Nehru-Gandhi family. I followed Rahul Gandhi in Uttar Pradesh, and the kind of crowd that he got was amazing.
And how do Indians think about the fact that she was Italian-born and became Indian through marriage to Rajiv Gandhi? Is that still a factor?
The common man probably doesn't think it's an ideal situation to have a foreigner leading your country, but I do think that she is an acceptable entity now. She's learned Hindi. She wears a sari. She wears a sari very well. She's fluent in Hindi. She's not as fluent as she should be because there's still a thick Italian accent. But to a large majority, she represents the Gandhi family rather than representing Italy.
Monica Chopra, India's historically cool relations with Washington warmed considerably under the BJP Prime Minister Vajpayee. How is that likely to change under a Congress Party-ruled government under Sonia Gandhi?
We'll have to wait and watch, but the foreign policy analysts feel that the relationship will probably get stronger and perhaps more transparent, because the BJP was always using this nationalist platform and didn't like to be seen associated with the American government, whereas the Congress doesn't have any qualms on that score. So it would probably be a more meaningful relationship and probably a more open relationship.
And if the BJP's theme of India shining, that is, a celebration of India's newly exploding middle class, was not enough to win it this victory, how is Sonia Gandhi's Congress Party likely to reach out to that much larger, still impoverished number of Indians?
Well, you know, the whole theme of the Congress Party in the elections was not the middle class. It was the common man. And in fact, the whole India shining theme of the Bharatiya Janata Party ignored rural Indian, ignored poor India, ignored distressed India. And by focusing only on a certain class, not only the middle class, but amongst the middle class, the upper middle class, a lot of people, a lot of analysts feel that it actually the whole India shining campaign backfired. I think in terms of economic policy, I don't think the Congress is going to do any major readjustment, but it's going to have a much bigger canvas. I mean, there's going to be an inclusion of rural India, and that's what it said in its manifesto. So I do think it's going to reach out to a much larger segment of people than the BJP did.
Monica Chopra, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Monica Chopra is covering the Indian elections for the Boston Globe. She spoke with us from New Delhi. We're talking tonight about the impact of Brown versus the Board of Education 50 years on. Harvard Law professor Charles Ogletree Jr., 2 years old at the time of the Brown decision, grew up in the world it was supposed to change. A half century on, he sees its impact on his own life and the nation's, but also profound shortfalls in its effect. To make up for Brown's failings, he says, black communities are increasingly assuming responsibility for educating their own children, from after-school programs that teach algebra to African Americans to charter schools focused on the needs of minorities. Tonight on Point, Charles Ogletree on life in the era of Brown versus the Board of Education. What was this historic decision supposed to achieve? Has it worked? What has the country learned about itself, about race, about education from Brown? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Charles Ogletree, Harvard Law professor and newly appointed head of the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice, Harvard Law School's new institute devoted to the study of race and the law. Good evening and welcome, Charles Ogletree.
Pleased to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. Thanks so much for being here. And a terrific book, but such a bittersweet kind of meditation on Brown versus Board of Education. You grant that it changed a lot, that it deserves all the big words, landmark, historic, and all the rest. But you also describe it as being ultimately, profoundly falling short of its fullest aspiration. Why the bittersweet attitude toward this historic Supreme Court ruling?
I would almost describe it as sweet bitter rather than bittersweet. Mm-hmm. The sweet part is that I stand here, tenured professor at Harvard Law School, Harvard Law School graduate, Stanford honors graduate, as someone who could not have imagined being here without Brown. I know I stand on broad shoulders of people like Thurgood Marshall and Robert Carter and Oliver Hill and Spotswood Robinson, African-American lawyers who could not attend the institutions that they integrated. They made the ultimate sacrifice by being educated at places like Howard Law School, but using their considerable skills to open up the doors. So there's a sweetness. I come from a poor family. My father only finished the fourth grade. My mother only went to the 10th grade. My grandparents had no formal education. They grew up in a South that was segregated and racist. And yet, my life was remarkably different. Even though we were poor, even though we were on public assistance, I was able, through education, through the final opportunities created by Brown, to go to Stanford, to go to Harvard, and to now make a contribution. So,
and it wasn't different for random reasons. It was different because of this Supreme Court decision.
That's exactly right.
Small part.
That's exactly right. And it's different even though I was in California. I was not in Mississippi. I was not in Alabama or Arkansas, where my parents had come from. And it was different another way. So that's the sweet part of it, mm-hmm. that it opened up doors. There's a lot of bitterness, and I write the bitterness. Well, let me say, I write the sweet part of it because I want young people, particularly people in these communities of Dorchester, Mattapan, and Roxbury to...
In the Boston area.
Exactly.
And elsewhere across our listenership
exactly.
in Milwaukee and...
across the country. Mm-hmm. In urban America to take a look at this and say, you know what, it's not where you start from that determines where you go. Because so many people want to give up. The sense of hopelessness and despair is common in urban America because of white flight as a result of integration and black middle-class flight. So I want to have a message for young people and for parents for young people, don't give up, don't give in, despite the despair and the malaise that you feel now. On the other hand, there is a lot of bitter. And the bitter is that there was massive resistance to integration. Whites just did not want to go to school with blacks, eat in restaurants with blacks, stay at hotels with blacks, or do any other thing that you think are common things that citizens and human beings would do.
For the better part of a century after the Civil War, that resistance was just built into the Jim Crow system. But Brown versus Board of Education kind of brought it to a head, crystallized the object of resistance.
Indeed. In fact, Brown changed the law. It ended legal segregation. But it did not change the hearts or minds of those who were deeply committed to segregation, whether they were Governor George Wallace in Alabama or Governor Orville Faubus in Arkansas or the members of Congress that called themselves the Southern Manifesto.
But here's what gets interesting. Was that then the failure of Brown or the failure of a people?
I think it's some of both. What this book does, All Deliberate Speed, is to tell you that there are two Browns. The one that we celebrate
literally
on Monday. Right. We celebrate on Monday, May 17th, 1954's 50th anniversary, a decision that said separate but equal is inherently unequal. The problem is that the court refused to give a remedy. We had a right to end segregation, but they didn't come up with a remedy. It took them until May 31st, 1955, more than a year later, before they decided the remedy. And what they decided then was absolutely tragic and disappointing. What the court said in Brown 2 was that they ordered the courts to end segregation, but they did so by saying that the lower courts are expected to end segregation, but they had to do so, quote, with all deliberate speed. That language became the downfall of Brown.
Those three words.
All deliberate speed. And that's why I named the book All Deliberate Speed, because Brown, and on the one hand, can be celebrated for what it did, but Brown, too, gave a message to the South that the court wasn't prepared to enforce it. And what's troubling is that this is not the first controversial decision about the Supreme Court. Supreme Court had to decide in 1973 the right of choice in the abortion case. Mm. It didn't stop the court from issuing its decision. And after the 2000 election, it had to decide Bush versus Gore, a very hotly contested decision. Mm. It didn't stop the court. And I think this was an example of the court always having difficulty when it comes with race. Although the cases were unanimous, they did not have the moral courage to say you have to end it now, and we've never had the court fully committed to enforcing it the way that it should have been enforced to give black children and poor children an equal opportunity for quality education.
That all deliberate speed phrase being a kind of doorway into foot dragging and diversion and every sort of prolonging, pushing out of the very integration that the court asked
That's
for.
Exactly right. In fact, the Brown lawyers, Thurgood Marshall and the lawyers, were so happy to win Brown 2, the all deliberate speed, until a secretary looked up the word deliberate in the dictionary and found out that it meant slow. And then they realized, oh, my God, we thought we had a great victory. Thurgood Marshall said, I thought I was the smartest man in the world when I won the case, and I went back and I thought I was the dumbest man in the world, did not realize that the court had done a sleight of hand in the second decision by taking away the very moral fabric of the decision by saying you can do it at your own pace.
At your own pace, and that pace turned out to be in many cases very, very slow, and so slow that in some cases it's really never happened.
That's exactly right.
We're talking tonight with Charles Ogletree, Jr. His new book is All Deliberate Speed, Reflections on the First Half Century of Brown versus Board of Education. You can join the conversation tonight. 50 years on, how has the Brown versus Board of Education decision affected your life? How has it affected the nation's life? Was your school life, your whole life, changed by Brown? Were you bussed? Were you integrated? And what was Brown supposed to achieve? Has it worked? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the impact of Brown versus Board of Education on a half century of American life, of African-American life. My guest is Charles Ogletree, Jr. He's professor at Harvard Law School and author of the new book, All Deliberate Speed. It's an interesting combination, Charles Ogletree, of your own life, so heavily imprinted with this Supreme Court ruling, and the life of the nation, and the kind of meditation of a jurist on everything that flowed from Brown, how Brown itself was created, and, of course, this phrase, all deliberate speed, which you say goes back to the Greek, festina lente, which Abraham Lincoln knew a little bit about, using it when he talked about slavery. When he said, it will do no good to go ahead any faster than the country will follow, that is, on emancipation. And you quote him saying, you know the old Latin motto, festina lente, in his case, referring to Augustus Caesar's interpretation, make haste slowly. And certainly America has done that, some would say, at best, with this integration and education process.
Indeed. There's another president who used this phrase a decade or so ago, and that's President Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton, when he was in office, was very upset that he was not able to keep his promise to remove the military ban on homosexuality. Mm-hmm. And shortly after his first election, he said, I will proceed with all deliberate speed to lift the restriction. Even he probably didn't appreciate, because he did move at all deliberate speed, because it wasn't removed.
very deliberate as well. You've got this great story about President Eisenhower, who, of course, was president when the decision came down. He had appointed Chief Justice Earl Warren. And about him having dinner after the decision, saying that the worst decision he'd ever made was appointing Warren as Chief Justice. And you quote him saying, the Southern whites are not bad people. All they are concerned about is to see that their sweet little girls are not required to sit in school alongside some big overgrown Negroes. This is the president at the time.
Indeed. If you don't have the moral courage as the chief executive to talk about true integration in the 1950s, how can you expect Congress or how can you expect even the courts or the people? And Eisenhower quietly set the tone by not insisting early on in his administration that things would change. And I think that was the beginning of the end for true desegregation, as the Brown lawyers had expected and fought for.
But the president also said something wise or tragic, depending how you look at it, that you quote him saying, him adding to that, it is difficult through law and through force to change a man's heart.
It's both prescient and tragic, right? Because he foresaw the resistance that you could change the law, but you couldn't change people's hearts or minds. And on the other hand, it's tragic because the president could have made a big difference. We've had presidents who would use the bully pulpit to talk about moral issues. And indeed, President Eisenhower in 1958 sent federal troops into Arkansas to make sure that blacks are going to the school. And that's part of what he could have done. And I think the fact that President Truman, a few years earlier, had really stepped ahead of the whole court by integrating the military.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't the lack of leadership. President Truman said, we can't have credibility in the military when those who are given their lives don't have leaders who look like them who are given the orders.
But
that's what Eisenhower could have done.
Is it too easy, though, 50 years on, to say the court could have said do this right away, could have handed down a remedy, Eisenhower could have said make it so? I mean, how would that actually have happened, Charles Ogletree, even at all deliberate speed? We all saw the fireworks. They're famous. They're infamous. George Wallace and the schoolhouse door and all the rest. What alternate vision do you have of how this decision could have been implemented that would have been more speedy and more effective?
I think just saying the law is the law. I mean, that's one thing about our system of laws, that they're meant to make a difference, and they shouldn't be avoided. No one's above the law or no one's below the law. And what the court did is to give these African Americans who were citizens, who voted, who did everything right, half a victory. And it's not asking for jobs. It wasn't asking for housing. It wasn't asking for public transportation. It was saying, give the children a quality education. What's wrong with enforcing the right of an education? Why shouldn't children have basic fundamental rights? And it's because of that, the court, when the court doesn't speak with a strong voice, we have the tragedies, as I talk about in the book, in Greenwood, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in 1921, a race riot where a group of drunken and deputized whites were responsible for destroying what W.B. Du Bois called the Black Wall Street of America, a prosperous community. My website, www.alldeliberatespeed.com, talks about Tulsa, and I bring Tulsa in as a sense of when we don't have resolute and positive responses, we create these opportunities for people to exercise racism in a variety of ways. And here's a community that was destroyed more than 80 years ago, and we have not even had the courage to talk about it as part of our history, not black history, but American history. But that's the problem. It's the moral courage of our leaders. They have to take a strong stand to defend everyone's right to vote, to live in neighborhoods, to get an education. Those are not hard issues. They seem to be fundamental in a democracy.
I get the moral courage issue. That's pretty easy. On the other hand, changing the way millions of children go to school and where and how they're educated, that is not like changing a speed limit. I mean, it's got tons of pragmatic implications, just practical implications. How practically would you like to have seen it done differently? What could the court or Eisenhower have done? Would they have, I don't know, said we're going to start busing everybody next week?
One thing, resources, saying that there are consequences for desegregation. It costs money. That's one of the things to think about, plans that would make sense to those who are being displaced.
But not just resources to bring more books and blackboards to black schools, because separate was no longer enough. So you mean resources
toward
moving more people
to
go to school.
That's exactly right. So that it wasn't a disadvantage for whites to come to urban America or impossible for blacks to go to suburban America. I mean, what happened is that you created two communities, separate and unequal, and that did not change after 1954. The court allowed the country to become, in a sense, the modern-day form of apartheid, separation of the races. And that was the tragic continuation of life after Brown as opposed to the end of that life. And it wasn't that hard. The other reason it should have been done, education was the way to go to law school and to become a doctor or to be successful in business. And so what the court was going to do is create opportunities for poor and segregated African-Americans to contribute to American society, to have income, to have opportunity. That's best for the country.
But are you asking more than any court could deliver? I mean, we saw decades
of
fiery resistance. Could it have been done in a week, a month, a year, to 5 years even?
The question, it's not how long it would take. It's more to say that it has to be done now. And then once there's a sense that you don't have an option, it has to be done. Of course, things take time. But when you say everybody figure out their own timetable, what happened? In Virginia, they closed the public schools for 10 years.
Yeah.
That's what all deliberate speed means. And what happened in South Carolina, they closed the schools. And when you don't have the force of law and you don't have executives, governors, and others to carry it forth, that's the result. And that's the tragedy. In fact, that's why this is a national program. But in Boston, I came here in 1975. And all deliberate speed was very evident because in 1975,
more than 20 years after,
people were denying black children the right to attend public institutions. I mean, that tells you that some people, it wasn't the South, it wasn't Mississippi or North Carolina or Alabama, it was Boston, the cradle of liberty.
And still resisting it, literally hammer and tongs.
Indeed.
In 1975, we're talking with Charles Ogletree. His new book is All Deliberate Speed, Reflections on the First Half Century of Brown versus Board of Education. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Sharon's calling from North Attleboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Sharon. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm really glad that you're having this conversation right now. I grew up actually in the South End in Boston.
In Boston, yeah.
And I was bused from the South End into Charlestown and into Dorchester.
Mm-hmm.
And I traveled around. I actually have a PhD in chemistry, and I'm a research scientist at MIT, and I'm an African-American female. And
congratulations. You went the distance.
Well, and it's been a journey, let me tell you. It's not been easy.
Do you feel like a beneficiary of Brown versus Board of Education or something more ambivalent?
Absolutely.
A beneficiary.
Yes, absolutely. Because if there was not Brown versus the Board of Education, I would not be a PhD chemist today. I'm sure of it.
Well, so then here I am sitting with Charles Ogletree, Harvard Law School professor, you, Sharon, MIT PhD in chemistry. I mean, from this tiny subset, it looks like everything's beautiful here.
Well, let Sharon and us both finish the question. Yeah. Both of us can answer. Yeah. We could jump on this. Here's the point.
I would love to have a conversation with you just over coffee sometime. Maybe we could meet in Cambridge.
I promise you that will happen.
I'll email you. I'll look up your email address.
Okay. But... I want you to hear this, too. Let me just say this. Sharon and I are the people, after Brown, we made it through the keyhole. Mm-hmm. The door wasn't open.
Very fortunate.
As it was very few. I mean, the numbers look significant, symbolically look significant, but so many of our community never left urban America. So many did not have the beneficiaries of affirmative action. And I'm not saying this to be critical. I'm just saying that the reality is that I'm not complaining about my success. I'm glad for it. But I'm concerned about so many who've left behind and all of us who've made it. Even when we can talk about our own skills and accomplishments, I always say, but for the sacrifices of those whose shoulders we stand on, we would not be here. There have always been people who have been qualified, but they've not always been admitted. And whether it's MIT or Harvard or Michigan or any other place, it's a remarkable difference. What Brown did, it opened up the keyhole. It didn't really open up the door.
How would you, and Sharon, thank you for your call. Charles Ogletree, how would you describe the state of minority education, black education in America today?
I don't know if there's a thing called black education. I would say that the state of education is complex now because what you find is a sense of desperateness among parents trying to take care of their children. And you do see resegregation, as I talk about in the book, a massive resegregation.
Very widely.
And indeed, the Brown was not a case. It was five. They filed a lawsuit, these brilliant lawyers led by the Harvard-educated African-American lawyer Charles Hamilton Houston. Mm-hmm. They filed a lawsuit in Richmond, Virginia, but also in Topeka, Kansas. They filed one in Columbia, South Carolina, but they also in Wilmington, Delaware, and Washington, D.C. So the idea was that we're going to look at this massive problem of segregation. And the problem today is that those same places that were integrated by law in 1950 are more segregated now than they were 50 years ago. So the state is depressing. We have 30, 40, 50% dropout rates among African Americans and Hispanics in many urban schools. We have a world of difference in terms of the resources in urban and in suburban schools. And so there is a crisis in public education that's only growing worse. It's good that people, a few can make it to colleges and universities. A few could become doctors and lawyers or scientists. But the vast majority aren't getting adequate public education, aren't able to leave urban America, and are suffering greatly because we've never really realized the promise of Brown.
And you don't look at this as anything like simply a failure of education, as profound as that itself would be. You describe this as a continuing American failure, a continuing failure to live up to the founding ideals.
Indeed it is. Not only if you look at the words of the Constitution and the amendments of the Constitution, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, designed to end slavery, create equal protection under the laws and to give citizenship rights of voting. But if you look at the fact that when we solve a problem, it's not solving a black problem. If you improve education of children, that means that they can work, they can be healthy, they can be productive. And if you don't, then you have larger groups of people in prison, you have more unemployment, and you have more crime. And we just aren't smart about how to solve our problems. If we were, we would see that we receive many advantages to an educated populace. It would make us a very different world. We're losing the race with Asia, Europe. We're importing, and I'm a big, strong supporter of immigration, but we're importing thousands of people who are political scientists, who are engineers, and who have other expertise because we can't educate them in our own schools. That's a failure of education, but it's also a failure of an idea to talk about meeting our own needs with our own talent pool that we have right here in this country.
Thomas is calling from Jacksonville, North Carolina. Hi, Thomas. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Just fine, thanks.
The point I want to make is that we still have a institution of segregation. And when you look at the fact that more religious schools have started up in the last 10, 15 years than ever before, and if the religious institutions that we are still segregated by choice. So we still have an institutionalized segregated system.
Loud and clear, and in religious schools, which end up very often being white schools you're describing.
Absolutely. And when you look at the push for federal funding to recognize them credible schools, that will subtract from the funds of your inner city school.
Thomas, does that look to you like an ongoing effort to kind of end run Brown versus Board of Education?
It is definitely an end run. And it started with the mandatory busing. Instead of busing my kid, I will send my kid to a institution where I feel him safe under the disguise that the church schools have the same moral values and is a safe institution.
Right. There are many ways to move at deliberate speed. And Thomas, thank you for your call there. Charles Ogletree, I wish you'd give us a sense of your own educational path there in Merced, California. Were you aware of Brown versus Board of Education as a young man? Did you know it was out there, an engine working for you, however imperfectly?
Indeed, I did not. I was less than 2 years old when the Brown decision was decided. I was born December 31st, 1952. But I grew up in a town that could have been Mississippi or Alabama or North Carolina. It was California, but it was Merced, California, the San Joaquin Valley.
Mm-hmm.
This is where Cesar Chavez organized the farm workers, places like Delano and Fresno and Modesto in my town. I look back, and I have pictures that describe this in my own history, and realize that we had poverty, but we had pride. So I didn't even realize that we were poor because we had a network there. I didn't realize that we were segregated because we had such a strong network. But I did realize as I look back that the African Americans and Chicanos in California live in the south side of Merced, the poorest area, and the whites, by and large, live on the north side of Merced. And there literally was a railroad track that separated us. Almost every one of my elementary school students, colleagues, were black or Hispanic. And yet my parents, who had no formal education, my father only went to the fourth grade. My mother didn't go past the 10th grade. My grandparents grew up, just on the heels of slavery and segregation. They all thought education was important for their children and grandchildren, and so they pushed us. And so I went from despair and hopelessness to opportunity and optimism. My high school, becoming student body president, the first African American at Merced High School, going to Stanford University, graduating 3 years with honors, getting a master's degree, going to Harvard Law School. It was a sense of why this book was written, to give a message to young people saying you too can go from despair and hopelessness to optimism and opportunity. And so that's part of my message as well, not to just write a technical book about legal history and doctrinal analysis of law, but to say, let me tell my story at every step of my life from where I started to where I am today, and to say that I have a challenge. I can't just rest on my laurels. My job is to go out and do something and make sure that, now that I'm over the ladder, bring over others.
System far from perfect, but don't give up. And at the same time, look at what's still not quite right there. We're talking with Charles Ogletree, author of All Deliberate Speed. You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the impact of Brown versus Board of Education on a half century of American life, of African-American life. My guest is Charles Ogletree, Jr., professor at Harvard Law School and author of the new book, All Deliberate Speed. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Eric is calling from Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks.
Good. Well, my concern is that it's not enough just to bus students to school in order to integrate them. I think once the students are there, you really have to work on getting the students to work together, to understand each other, to fight racist attitudes, to get them to see each other as human beings, you know, to really get to accept each other.
And do you think that's going on, Eric?
I don't think it's going on enough. I worked at a school in South Boston, and I thought that racism was alive and well, you know, even a few years ago. So I'd like to see a lot more happening even now to fight racism and to really build acceptance.
Eric, thanks for your call, and let us pick that up. Charles Ogletree, I wanted to ask you on this very point then. Here we are 50 years on. Where do you look? Eric says there's still all kinds of racism out there and divisions and resegregation. Are you still putting your faith in integration?
Yes.
Or are you putting it somewhere else?
Absolutely. For a number of reasons. First of all, I'm a firm believer that as pervasive as racism is in this country, and I talk about it in the book, some of it is unconscious and not just conscious racism. And so I think there is hope for us to try to rethink and reapproach the challenges. And I also think that we can solve this problem. For example, one of the problems of the resegregation is a big problem is white flight. And what Eric talks about is interesting because whites have abandoned urban America, and I can't persuade people to come back into the city, but I can at least urge them to think about the totality of our community and why they don't think it's in some sense in the best interest of the community to have their children have an integrated experience. It doesn't make a lot of sense if the only time their child sees someone of color is if they're bussed in for classes, but they're not part of the community. They're really tenants. They're really guests. They're not mm-hmm. really a part of the community. Mm-hmm. And there has to be some outreach because the communities are getting more segregated by race. And it's a one way. The blacks and Hispanics who are poor can't leave urban America, and the whites and the black middle classes who are in suburban America won't come back to urban America. And my sense is that if we had more parents willing to take a chance and put their children in these urban schools, not as sacrificial lambs, but to improve education, to improve crime control, to improve the quality of life, their power, their presence, their economic power, their political power would make urban America a better place. I don't think we can abandon our cities. They are our lifeblood. And I think Eric's on an important point. We have to find ways to convince those who've left to rethink that and to become a part of the larger community.
But I don't see you sitting back waiting for that to happen. It could be a long time coming. You write that it may not be the integrated society envisioned in Brown may not be realized, and you talk about alternatives
right.
to deal directly with education challenges. Describe what you mean by that.
Well, first of all, as a lawyer and a law professional, legal scholar, it was not a comfortable thing to say that maybe we should focus less on the courts and more on other institutions. But that's the reality. Mm-hmm. The courts can't solve all our problems. Mm-hmm. We saw that in Brown, mm-hmm. and we see it even today. And so my urging is for parents to rethink the educational process, charter schools. My wife and friends started one here in the 1990s, the Benjamin Medical Charter School in Cambridge, not for our children. They were too old, but for those parents who were poor and powerless in the Cambridge public school system, and these children now learning math, science, and technology. On the other hand, I also think after-school programs, the Bell Foundation is a Boston-based program that teaches thousands of children in Boston, New York, and the District of Columbia in after-school programs. I think that we should have a longer school day, that we should talk about whether children should be in school until 5 or 6 o'clock. Parents shouldn't have to make a choice between being home with their children or working. Mm. I think we should think about a Saturday school. That's a radical notion, but it's a Saturday school that's different. It would involve providing educational opportunities not just for children but for parents. We're blaming parents today for failing children, but the parents are also products of these same schools. And my concern is this, that we have a situation where we have parents who are being asked to teach their children the new math, and they never learned the old math.
So forget about it.
It's not working.
It's not working.
And we need a Saturday school that's not just for children but for parents. I'd like to see a school where one room is for parents, for remedial education, parent skills, to learn things to empower them. A high school diploma doesn't mean in the year 2004 what it meant in 1930 or 1950 or 1970.
You mean it means more or less?
It means less. It means nothing by and large. I don't mean to be disparaging, but the fact of the matter is that we're not giving our parents enough power, educational power that means economic power and political power. And I would say let's work with parents. Instead of blaming them, let's give them a chance to become more powerful, more educated, and more integral in our communities.
I want to understand what exactly you're promoting on the charter school front. Are you saying let's create minority charter schools,
children? Not at all. Teach charter schools for all children because they're public schools, but they're diverse schools with diverse curriculum that focus on other things. That's interesting. The charter schools are open. It's interesting that black children came to the charter school we created in Cambridge. A few whites came and did exceptionally well, and the families were an integral part, and a few are there now. But anything that looks black, unfortunately, creates this unconscious racism.
But you've got, I'm looking at your website, 88% enrolled students at Benjamin Banneker, this charter school, are African-American.
That's exactly the point.
That's got to look black.
It is black, but it's not exclusive. It's black because whites won't come. Again, it's urban America. Come back to the community.
And is it working? We saw reports recently that charter schools have a pretty checkered record on their performance, including Benjamin Banneker.
Absolutely. Right.
Some pretty tough, 6% of the sixth grade achieving proficiency in math. Ouch.
Absolutely. These are children who have been completely rejected by the public school system, and their parents are starting all over. These are kids who are, by third grade, are already behind, are grades behind. And what the Benjamin Banneker Charter School says is that we're going to take kids who have not been accepted and give them a sense of pride, a sense of encouragement, and a sense of courage to take on the challenges. And to show what my colleague Howard Gardner has written about, that there are multiple intelligences that are important, not just the idea of reading and writing, artistic abilities, leadership abilities, issues of being able to think outside the box.
Still, having that math brings home the bacon.
That's exactly right. And that's why math is so important. And yet trying to make school enjoyable and pleasant is even more important. If children are coming to school, they're hungry. If they're coming to school, they're distracted. If they're coming to school, they're told that the curriculum is dumbed down. That's all failure. But it's also, this is a marathon. It's not a sprint. Mm. And at the same time, these children are considered failures on achievement tests. It's interesting when you see what they can do. If you look at the school, if you look at their pride, if you look at their excitement about coming every day, these are the people who are going to be the engineers, the doctors, the lawyers, the teachers of the next generation, people whom others have already rejected, like those in my community 50 years ago, will be the stars of tomorrow.
If they get those scores up, we've just got a minute left. You tell a story about your father attending your graduation from, I forget, Stanford or Harvard.
Well, he didn't attend either of those, is unfortunate.
Because he... And it seemed to me to sort of describe some transition that's happened here. He didn't feel what?
He was a poor black man from Alabama who had no formal education.
So even to stand there.
Exactly. So. What do you do, Mr. Ogletree? Well, I drive a truck. What do you do, Mr. Ogletree? I mean, and there was a sense of shame and disappointment. He finally came in 1983 when I was sworn into the U.S. Supreme Court, and it couldn't have been a prouder moment for me to see my father in the audience as I was sworn in, looking at Thurgood Marshall, the great colored lawyer, as he was called, and to see his pride and seeing his son in the same court with Thurgood Marshall. And so for me, it was a turning point. There was Thurgood Marshall, my hero. There was my father finally recognizing that the sacrifices were important. And it was, for me, a challenge to move forward, to make sure to move forward, not with all deliberate speed, but with dispatch.
Well, there one personal river crossed for your dad and many for you, Charles Ogletree. Thanks for being with us tonight. Thanks for the new book.
My pleasure.
Charles Ogletree's book, All Deliberate Speed, Reflections on the First Half Century of Brown versus Board of Education. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, the judge who wrote the decision legalizing gay marriage in Massachusetts reflects on Brown versus Board of Education. This is On Point. A federal judge in Boston has denied an 11th-hour appeal to prevent Massachusetts from issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Gay marriage is scheduled to become legal in the state starting Monday. Plaintiffs were hoping that U.S. District Judge Joseph Taro would overrule last fall's decision by the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court making gay marriage legal. They say they will immediately appeal today's decision to the First U.S. Circuit Court. Yesterday, in Northampton, Massachusetts, the author of the decision that legalized gay marriage, Massachusetts Chief Justice Margaret Marshall, spoke about the upcoming 50th anniversary of Brown v. Board of Education's decision. While she did not reference her court's landmark gay marriage decision, her address offered insight into the thinking that may have guided her opinion. In this excerpt, Margaret Marshall looks back at the lessons she learned growing up in apartheid-era South Africa.
Because I lived so many years under the heel of an oppressive government, and because I have known the fear of living in circumstances where the state has almost total control over one's life and one's property, I am passionately committed to ensuring equal justice for all in our Massachusetts courts. I know that the rule of law, applied fairly and equally, is the essence of our liberty. And I have seen the good that comes when individuals, in grand, heroic ways, and in small, quiet ways, stand up for equality and justice. I also know that even here in this great nation, the ghosts of past discrimination have not been laid to rest. Equality of all persons remains an aspiration, a goal in our courts and in the larger society. But we all know there's more work to do. The United States was, quote, the first nation in the history of the world, said President Lyndon Johnson, to be founded with a purpose. That purpose is not to preserve power for the powerful. That purpose is to expand the boundaries of human freedom in an ordered society under an impartial rule of law that treats each of us with equal dignity and respect. Brown reminds us that equality is not a given. It is a condition of life that we create day by day, bit by bit, person by person. Nearly two centuries ago, Supreme Court Chief Justice John Marshall wrote that people make the Constitution and people can unmake it. It is the creature of their will and it lives only by their will. In celebrating the golden anniversary of Brown against Board of Education, we also celebrate the timeless faith and courage of the ordinary men, women, and children who keep our Constitution alive. Time and again throughout our history, just when we think we know what liberty means, just when we think we've come close to achieving it for everyone, a voice is heard, one speaking of injustice. And we are called upon to renew our commitment to equality, to the fair administration of justice, to the rule of law. African Americans and their allies taught us that it is not enough for only white people to be free. The suffragists and their allies taught us that it is not enough for only men to be able to vote. All people are created free and equal. Those are the commanding, the powerful opening words of the Massachusetts Constitution. Our federal Constitution commands that no state shall deny to any person the equal protection of the laws. These charters of rights, our national commitment to the rule of law, these are the source of our vitality as a nation. It is these that continue to make us an inspiration for people around the world.
Margaret Marshall, Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, who wrote the opinion legalizing gay marriage, speaking yesterday in Northampton, Massachusetts, the state will begin issuing gay marriage licenses on Monday. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.